the debate between people who call themselves originalists and everybody else is about whether that we can discern that meaning by staring hard at the words, or whether we need to apply our own understanding of the world in which we live.
It would make a difference if the Commerce Clause was enforced according to its original meaning, if the Necessary and Proper Clause was enforced according to its original meaning, if the Second Amendment was enforced according to its original meaning.
The fact that there's no Equal Rights Amendment in the Constitution is a reflection of the fact that our contemporary society accepted women's equality, and so there was no need to amend the Constitution.
If those provisions are so open-ended that they could be construed to mean anything that we want them to mean, then why did they have to be redacted?
Well, welcome to this 10th debate of the second season of the SOHO Forum at the Subculture Theater in downtown Manhattan. I'm Gene Epstein, director of the SOHO Forum. We're a monthly debate series that features topics of special interest to libertarians and aims to enhance social and professional ties within New York City's libertarian community. We're partnered with Reason Magazine in promoting these debates, and you can catch audio and video of all our events on the Reason podcast, which you'll find in the iTunes store. As a special bonus this evening, Reason is making available its current issue of its magazine with the title Burn After Reading. You won't want to miss this. It includes Reason's classic pot brownies, Reason's recipe for prison hooch, how to get on a jury, outlaw mags, exactly the kind of material we want to present tonight because we've got lawyers in the room. Also another article called Don't Let Uncle Sam Seize Your Salami. So you don't want to miss out on that. And you want to get a subscription to Reason Magazine. I read it faithfully every month myself. This is an Oxford-style debate in which the audience initially votes for, against, or undecided on the resolution. And then again, after the debate is over, whoever moves the vote in his or her favor is declared the winner. Go into SOHOvote.com to cast your initial vote. You'll find that tonight's resolution reads, the U.S. Constitution should be interpreted and applied according to the original meaning communicated to the public by the words of the text. Now, with every SOHO Forum, we have a warm-up act. And this evening, we are pleased to bring back Dave Smith, who runs the great podcast, Part of the Problem. Dave, please come to the stage and warm us up.
Oh, hello. Hello, am I on? What's going on, everybody? How about another hand for Gene Epstein, huh? Puts these wonderful events together. Oh, this is an exciting one, man. I've been to a lot of these things, but this one I'm pumped for. And you got free copies of Reason Magazine, everybody. Just hold that in your hand and know you are holding the biggest book Gary Johnson ever read. And that is... He got all the way through that. He mostly looks at the pictures, but he enjoyed it. And I don't know why. I can't help myself sometimes. I love Reason Magazine. Don't cut out my intro this time. All right. Someone saw me taking shots at Cato. All right. What a great time. We have the one of my favorite human beings on the planet, celebritarian Judge Napolitano, moderating tonight's debate. We're all honored that he would be here. Judge Napolitano, or as MSNBC refers to him, a Russian spy. And I don't know. I haven't gotten to the bottom of it yet. You have to forgive MSNBC. They hate Russia. They're really pissed off at Russia. There's still some sore feelings ever since they abandoned communism. And that's just, it's fresh wounds for MSNBC. They have a lot of... The Constitution! We're here to talk about, right, our founding document. The Constitution was written to restrain the power of the state, and I don't know if you've checked, but it's doing a great job, and it's doing just what it was intended to do. I saw Donald Trump the other day. They asked him, you know, what he was going to do, and he was like, I got to check Article 1, Section 8 before I do anything. I got to make sure I really... Of course, I mean, the Constitution is still very relevant today. We did, we elected a brilliant orator who taught constitutional law. Still talking about Trump. It was at Trump University. He gave the course. It was Benjamin Franklin, supposedly, he said, right, when he came out, and they said, "What have you given us?" Right, some lady was like, "By the way, that lady sounds pretty pushy in the story." Like, it's like, "What have you given us?" Like, "Jesus, I'm working." But she's like, "And what did he say?" Right, he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." Don't you kind of wish you were right there when he said that, and you were just like, "Listen, we're not going to be able to keep this thing. So you really, like, you're going to have to rethink this whole idea." And then I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said something like, I always butcher these quotes, but it was something like, "The tree of liberty has to be watered with the blood of tyrants," and you know, patriots. Oh, okay. Oh, that. Well, I liked my version better. Sorry. Was it patriots? Why do we always have to die? Whatever happened to? I'm just saying, I don't know if you've seen that tree, but there's not a lot of new leafy growth on it. It's looking. By the way, I don't even know. I don't even believe that any of the founders said half the stuff we credit to them. I'm conspiratorial about that. Henry Ford definitely didn't say half the things we give him credit for. No one person had that many great quotes. I don't believe it. And also, while I'm getting into conspiracy, I don't think Ben Affleck and Matt Damon wrote Good Will Hunting. I don't believe it for a second, okay? There's no way they wrote that. Really? They put out that masterpiece and then just crap for the rest of their careers? Like, it doesn't make sense. At 22, they banged out that masterpiece? It's like if Shakespeare just, like, wrote one Shakespeare and then it was, like, just three Bourne Identities after that. And it was like, I don't know. I don't think this is the same guy, probably. But that's just me. I don't mean to go all conspiratorial on you guys, really. But really, the Constitution was a conspiracy. That's how this whole country started, right? It was just like a few guys who were like, we're tired of this. We're going to start our own government. You know, they're like the original Zionists, if you think about it. But I can't. Oh, all right. Thanks, three Jews. All right. Let's move off that. Touchy subject. All right. Moving right along. No problem. I don't know. I've always kind of thought, like, the Constitution is kind of, like, I mean, I like it. I read it. It's a good book. But I just don't, you know, it doesn't seem like it applies that much anymore. No one follows it, you know? But then, like, Europe started locking up every blogger they don't like. And I was like, I'm pretty into that First Amendment thing. That's pretty cool. I'm glad we have that. And also, I'm glad we don't have royalty like that. Just for that alone, it's worth it, getting rid. How do people still obsess over, like, the prince getting married and stuff like that? Like, isn't that the most disrespectful thing to everyone who died in the revolution, you know? The last just war that we fought? Isn't that? Well, to be fair, the South had a pretty good argument. But come on, if I can't say it here, where am I going to be able to say stuff like that? Freaking northern meddlers. Let them go. But really, we still got to watch the thing. Like, I was in Canada recently, in Toronto, and they still have the Queen on their money. And just that alone, I feel like, is worth fighting a war over. Just to not have that stupid Queen on our money. Like, don't you hate? It's like, she's not a queen. She's just some lady. She's just some old lady who everybody is telling her that she's a queen. And then, like, when you talk to, like, English people, they're like, yeah, we have a queen, but it's just, like, for tradition. We don't really have a queen. But you have a queen. You can't have a queen in 2018. Like, you shouldn't have a queen and the internet at the same time. Like, you should have one or the other. You should have to give up internet if you're still going to have a queen, okay? And does she know, like, does the queen really know that she's not a real queen? Or does she just think she's being super cool about her powers? Like, she's an old lady. Like, maybe she's goes senile and starts thinking she's a real queen. Like, what would happen in England if tomorrow the queen just came out and was like, I declare war. We're all going to war now. Like, does everyone in England just like, oh, I guess we got to go to war because the queen, or do they like, now someone's got to tell her that, like, Someone's got to be like, hey, we've just kind of been humoring you this whole time. You're not really a queen. Or is it maybe a queen just sends him to war? I don't think a queen is going to be prepared for modern war. It's like, here's a sword and a Bible. Good luck. Like, anyway. I don't know. Maybe if we could go back in time and talk to the founders, we'd be like, you should be proud. Don't worry. Give it a couple hundred years. But soon, this great nation will send Dennis Rodman to bring peace in the Koreas. Finally, this whole thing will come together, and we will. Man, do any of you guys feel like we're like in one of those movies where there's like someone has a time machine, and then they go back and they mess up? And then, like, you come to the future that was never supposed to be, and, like, you're like, what? Dennis Rodman's in North Korea? Like, what? Like, someone needs to come back and fix everything, and you're like, oh, yeah, that made more sense. Okay, yeah. Yeah, Ron Paul won in 2020, and everything's fine, or whenever, 2012, whenever he ran. Yeah, a few sad Ron Paul supporters out there. He's still doing good, don't worry. Isn't it great that, like, Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump can actually sit down at, like, for all the things that any of us may not like about Donald Trump, you know, like, Kim Jong-un looked at him and he was like, finally, America's making some sense. Like, I can't believe we finally picked a serious leader after all these years of joking around with these clowns. There's, like, someone, like, make it, like, I feel like, like, they're going to sit down, and then everyone else is going to leave the room, and then they're just going to, like, look at each other, and they'll be like, is it just us? Is it just us? And then they're just like, dude, I think you're awesome. And he's like, me too, man. That is hilarious what you're doing on Twitter. We don't have Twitter or food, but we do. I love what you guys are doing there. All right. Hey, man, I know all you guys are. I'm very excited to get this thing started. I always love coming here, so thanks for having me. Enjoy the night, everybody, and have a good one.
Dave Smith, you should listen to his podcast, Part of the Problem. It's really great. Well, now will go to the main event. Arguing for the affirmative on the resolution, we have Georgetown law professor Randy Barnett. Randy, please come to the stage. Arguing for the negative, we have Cornell law professor Michael Dorf. Mike, please come to the stage. And acting as guest moderator for the evening's debate, we have the judge who needs no introduction, Judge Andrew Napolitano. Judge, please take over from here.
Dave Smith, we have a tough act to follow. Wow. So you probably know the rules. Professor Barnett will speak first for 12 and a half minutes, and then Professor Dorf, and then they can rebut each other. Then we'll get to questions, and then they'll do a final summation. We'll stick pretty close to the time period, though I'll be a little bit flexible. You understand the proposition, which Professor Barnett will define. He'll tell you what originalism is, or at least his understanding of it, and he'll make that argument. And of course, we can expect the counter from Professor Dorf. This is a very, very hot topic in law schools, particularly since the mortal demise of Justice Scalia, who is credited with at least bringing it to our consciousness. Some would say he failed because the court never really went along with it. Some would say he succeeded beyond his wildest imaginings to have intellects like our two debaters and all of you listening over the topic of originalism. It's not a word I would use at Fox because it's a different kind of audience, but here we're going to beat it around and beat it to death and explain it and explore it. Professor Barnett, the floor is yours in defense of the proposition.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Napolitano. Thanks, Gene, for inviting me. How about another hand for Dave Smith? Isn't he fantastic? I just wanted him to argue my side, you know. I think he could do better than I'm going to do. It's a great pleasure to be on a panel that's moderated by my friend, Judge Napolitano, and also to be debating my other friend, Mike Dorf, who I've known for many, many years, and to be here for the first time. I thought I'd start off by talking about how I became an originalist, because I wasn't an originalist for most of my career. I started in law school. I had a law professor who was actually a close collaborator of Professor Dorf's. Larry Tribe was my law professor, and after I took Larry Tribe for con law, I just sort of said that was it for con law for me. I didn't want anything to do with the Constitution after that, and it wasn't Professor Tribe's fault. He was a great professor. It's that when I went through the case book and I turned the pages and I would get to a part of the Constitution like the Ninth Amendment, for example, that said something I liked, and then I'd turn the page of the case book and I'd find out that the Supreme Court said it really didn't mean anything. Or we're not going to enforce that provision, and we're not going to enforce that provision. And so by the time I was done with my constitutional law class, I was done with constitutional law, frankly. And when I became a law professor, I went to practice. I was a criminal prosecutor in Chicago. When I went into teaching, I became a contracts professor, because in contracts, you know, writings still matter. You still interpret writings. You still follow writings. It matters what you sign. And so that's what I was. And then inadvertently, I sort of got pulled into constitutional law. I won't tell the story about how that happened, but I want to tell the story of how I became an originalist, because I wasn't. I had Ronald Dworkin with my professor in law school. I would have to say that if I was anything, I was a Dworkinian when it came to constitutional interpretation. And the reason was is that everything I heard about originalism I thought was wrong. I objected to it. I mean, I didn't understand why we should be bound by the framers of the Constitution. What authority did these framers have over us? And not only that, but there were these practical problems with originalism, figuring out what the framers intended. Originalism, I actually wrote an article critical of originalism in which I characterized this view as the framers as our wardens, that they're our keepers, and they'd somehow have to control us. And that the way that we would decide constitutional cases is by channeling the framers, as in, oh, framers, would you think that the thermal imaging of a house to detect increased heat emanating from it, indicating marijuana cultivation, is a search? Tell us, framers, do you think that? Nowadays, that goes under the rubric of what would Madison do? You decide questions based on what would Madison do. And because of these problems with originalism, I myself was not one. And then I was teaching a seminar on constitutional law at Boston University, and there was a footnote in one of the readings I had assigned, and it was a footnote to a man named Lysander Spooner. Now, how many of you have heard of Lysander Spooner? I can't see you because of the lights. So you're going to have to applaud if you heard him, because I can't see any hands. So if you've heard of Lysander Spooner, you probably know his famous article, which I read in college, called No Treason, the Constitution of No Authority, which I read in college and I like very much. And so I'm teaching this class, and there's a footnote, and the footnote says, see Lysander Spooner, The Unconstitutionality of Slavery, 1846. Or maybe it's 1845. And I'm thinking, Lysander Spooner wrote about the unconstitutionality of slavery in 1845? This is 20 years before the 13th Amendment's ratified. What could he possibly have said? So I had the library bring me a copy of it. It turns out it was in a 6-volume collected works of Lysander Spooner. Little did I know that he wrote anything other than No Treason. And here it was. It was a 280-page book. And he'd written it in response to an abolitionist named Wendell Phillips, who was a very close associate of William Lloyd Garrison. And the radical abolitionists under Garrison had basically been arguing that the Constitution was a covenant with death and an agreement with hell because it sanctioned slavery. And therefore, their motto was no union with the slave power. They wanted to basically secede in order to separate themselves from the South, who were slaveholders. But this was their argument. And then right about then, in 1844, they released Madison's notes, which had been secret. Madison's notes for the Constitutional Convention had been secret until then, and they got released. And then Wendell Phillips, who was a Harvard-trained student of Justice Story, read these notes, and they see all these references to slavery. And so he publishes a pamphlet called The Constitution, a Pro-Slavery Document, in which he indicts the framers. Say, we were right all along. The Constitution is evil. And look at all these things from Madison's notes showing that the intention of the framers was to protect slavery. So what does Spooner do? Spooner writes a book in response called The Unconstitutionality of Slavery, in which he argues framers' intent doesn't matter. We're not bound by the intentions of the framers. It's irrelevant. We're only bound by the meaning of the words they wrote. We're only bound by the meaning of the words we wrote, or what the resolution would say, the public meaning of the words they wrote. And because they actually didn't mention slavery, they used euphemisms to refer to slavery. They said persons held to service. They sometimes said other persons. But they never used the word slavery, which they had at their disposal. They used euphemisms. He says, we're not bound by the evil possible meaning of these euphemisms. We're only bound by the good ones unless they put it in writing, unless they actually came right out and said so. And this, I thought, was remarkable. I said, this is a version of originalism that I could actually get behind. That is, we're not bound by the intentions of the framers. We're only bound by the public meaning of what they said. It took me many years before, and thinking about originalism, before I finally concluded that I think Spooner was wrong about the Constitution and the public meaning of the Constitution, that these words, which were used as euphemisms, would in context have been understood by the public to refer to slavery. And therefore, they did refer to slavery. So I think his actual argument was wrong. But his approach, I thought, was very sympathetic. But unbeknownst to me, this idea of original public meaning as opposed to framers' intent had already been advanced and proposed by Justice Antonin Scalia before he was a justice. When he was on the Court of Appeals in the D.C. Circuit, he had gone to the Reagan Justice Department and given him some talk saying, look, you guys should stop talking about the framers and the intentions of the framers and start talking about original public meaning. So eventually, this is by the late 90s, it was reading Spooner that persuaded me that this was a viable alternative, and I eventually concluded that I myself was an originalist. In part, I've been doing a lot of work on the original meaning of the Ninth Amendment, doing a lot of work on the original meaning of the Second Amendment, and I had to ask myself after a while, why did I care about the meaning of this if I'm not an originalist? And why do all my audiences care so much about the original meaning of these provisions if they're not originalists? And eventually, I reconciled myself with originalism and became one. So let's talk about what originalism is and why we should be originalists, why we should interpret the Constitution according to its original public meaning. All right, so I've got a copy of the Constitution here. You can all see it. It's an actual real thing. And what is this thing? What is this thing? Well, here I'm going to tell you what this is, and it's not necessarily what you expect. This is not the law that governs us. This is not the law that governs us. We don't consent or agree to this law. This is one of Spooner's earlier points, as you remember, from No Treason. We don't consent. We're never asked to consent. What is this document? This document is the law that governs those who govern us. This is the law that governs those who govern us. So then, and how do we know that? How do we know that? We know that because, unlike us who were not asked to consent, each and every person who governs pursuant to the powers created by this document takes an oath, a personal oath, to follow this Constitution. And I'm going to read you what that oath says. It's right in here, in this Constitution. It says, this is Article 6, Section 3, the senators and representatives before mentioned and members of the several state legislatures and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. This Constitution, not the Constitution, this Constitution, the written one. All right, so if this is the law, and that's a unanimous 100% consent by those who are empowered by the Constitution to follow this Constitution. So what does that entail? That entails that the people who are to be bound by this law can no more change the meaning of the law that governs them without going through the appropriate change process, which is defined in this Constitution by Article 5, than we can change the laws that are imposed upon us without going through the legislative process. So that when we run into a speed limit, we are bound to obey that speed limit, even if it's an unreasonably low speed limit. We're not allowed to adopt a living speed limit or a speed limit at the moment speed limit without going through the legislative process. And the same thing that's true for us and the laws that are used to bind us is true for the law that's used to bind them. And that simply yields the following proposition. The Constitution, the meaning of the text of the Constitution, should remain the same until it's properly changed. The meaning, that's it, that's originalism, by the way, in one sentence. The meaning of the Constitution should remain the same until it's properly changed by amendment. So that means, in order to figure out what the text of the meaning it is, we see what was it,
What did it mean when it was enacted in 1787, in 1789 when the Constitution was enacted, in 1791 when the first 10 amendments were added to it, in 1768 when the 14th Amendment was ratified? What did it mean then? And therefore, that's what it means today unless it was properly changed. Okay, so I only have 2 minutes left. I want to stick within my time. So I want to, this morning on his blog, Professor Dorff had a nice blog post about tonight's debate. And here's what he said on this blog post. He said, from my perspective, quote, from my perspective, far better 9 Justice Gorsuches than 1 President Trump. I probably am not going to argue with him about that, Mike. All right, but let's start over. From my perspective, better 9 Justice Gorsuches than 1 President Trump. I wish that my conservative friends would accept the converse. Better 9 Ginsburgs than 1 Trump. All right, so that's what he said today. With all due respect, Mike, I think that this is the wrong question to ask. I think in light of this debate, this is the wrong question to ask. So here is the question I think that I would leave you with and see what you think. I would think, would you rather that Donald Trump appointed 9 justices who share Donald Trump's values and believe in a living constitution in which they can change and update this constitution so that it actually reflects their values? Would you like Donald Trump to appoint those justices, or would you rather that he appoint not 8 more Justice Gorsuches who would actually follow the original public meaning of this text, whether it cut in the right or whether it cut to the left? Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Barnett. Professor Dorff.
It's a great pleasure to be here tonight. I have a confession. I am not a libertarian full stop, although I am a civil libertarian, and many of my best friends are libertarians. So I want you to begin by imagining that we had a different resolution before us today. Suppose the resolution were about something entirely different. Suppose it said driverless cars should be legal on all roads in the United States. And the speaker who was promoting the resolution got up and told you a very nice story about how he came to be in favor of driverless cars. And then in his final 3 or 4 minutes said, and you know, of course, driverless car technology isn't quite where it needs to be just yet. If we allow it to be fully legal on all U.S. roads today, we'll have mayhem. And therefore, when I say driverless cars should be legal, all I mean is that people should be able to use cars equipped with GPS units. Right? You would say that that speaker had pulled a fast one. Likewise, if this were 2002 or 2003, and we were debating the resolution, the United States should invade Iraq, and the party with the affirmative told you a heartwarming story about people in Iraq, and then said, and therefore we should invade Iraq with economic aid and with kisses, you would say, you're not defending the resolution. The resolution today is the U.S. Constitution should be interpreted and applied according to the original meaning communicated to the public by the words of the text. What I wrote in the part of the blog post that Randy didn't tell you about, and I assume you haven't all read it in the intervening 30 seconds or so, is that the reason why I think better 9 Justices Gorsuch than 1 President Trump is because this kind of debate has such low stakes when original public meaning is defined in the way that Randy and many of his friends define it. Now, that's good from my perspective, right? I would much rather have people who claim to be originalists actually defending the living Constitution, as Randy has just done for you, than to have them defending original intent and original concrete expected applications as people who called themselves originalists in the late 1970s and early 1980s did. Why? Because Randy and I are in complete agreement that the way to figure out the answer to our contemporary problems is not to ask what would James Madison have thought about whether attaching a GPS tracker to a car is a search or thermal imaging is a search. That's an absurd question, right? That's not the right way to go about construing any law. Rather, what we have to do is to figure out what the words mean. We agree about that. But Randy is knocking on an open door when he says we are bound by the text. Nobody thinks that the text of the courts are empowered to change the text of the Constitution. The debate between people who call themselves originalists and everybody else is about whether that we can discern that meaning by staring hard at the words, or whether we need to apply our own understanding of the world in which we live. Now, you don't have to take my word for that. Here's James Madison in Federalist 37. All new laws, and he's talking about the ratification of the Constitution here, so he includes the Constitution in laws. All new laws, though penned with the greatest technical skill and passed on the fullest and most mature deliberation, are considered as more or less obscure and equivocal until their meaning be liquidated. Their meaning be liquidated, right? They don't have a fixed meaning originally because the wealth of problems that confronts human beings is so great that the words can't capture all of the answers, right? So the meaning has to be liquidated and ascertained by a series of particular discussions and adjudications. Now, what does that mean in practice? It does not mean, as Randy suggests and as people parody, people who believe in the living Constitution suggest, that nine justices sit around and think, what would I like to replace the Constitution with? What they do inevitably is they start with the text of the Constitution. They look at how it's used in context. So the reason why we can say that although we sympathize with Lysander Spooner's understanding of the words, right, the absence of the word slavery, you look at the whole structure of the Constitution and you say it's not realistic in light of what we know to impute to the people who adopted and ratified the Constitution the meaning that slavery is illegal. Nor would it be a reasonable interpretation for us. Randy asks, what is it that makes the Constitution law? And he tells us what doesn't make it law. What doesn't make it law is the fact that a bunch of people over 200 years ago, many of them not related to us, from an exclusive group of the population, ratified it. We were in complete agreement that that's not what makes it law. So what does make it law? Well, we have different answers to that question. Randy thinks that what makes it law is that it promotes the virtues of a good society, as he explains in one of his books. I can quote you from that in a little bit. But let me tell you why. What I think makes it law. What I think makes it law is simply the fact that it's accepted around here as law. The best jurisprudence book ever written was written by an English legal scholar named H.L.A. Hart. It's called The Concept of Law. And what Hart tells us is that the law consists of primary rules, those are the rules like the speed limits that affect all of us, and secondary rules, rules that govern the people who govern us. And behind all of this is a so-called rule of recognition. Think of it in sort of Lord of the Rings fashion, one rule to rule them all, right? The rule of recognition is what grounds the whole thing. And that is ultimately a matter of social practice. It's a matter of social practice among governing officials and so forth. And so what makes the Constitution have any authority at all is the fact that it's accepted. But what's accepted is not necessarily its original public meaning, not because the judges have changed the original public meaning, but because the original public meaning is radically indeterminate on all sorts of questions. Here are just a list of questions I thought are in the air these days that the Constitution might be invoked to answer. Can a sitting president be indicted? Can a president pardon himself? Does Congress have the power to require state and local officials to enforce federal law? Does the Second Amendment protect an individual right to possess firearms? Do the Fifth, Ninth, and Fourteenth Amendments protect a right to abortion? Does the Eighth Amendment permit the death penalty? And if so, when? For juveniles? If not, what's the age cutoff? Some of these are questions the Supreme Court has answered. Some of them are questions the court hasn't yet had the opportunity to answer and may never answer. But when the court looks to contemporary values and discovers that the meaning is different from what people who, if they thought about it, might have had a view about this in the late 18th century or in 1868, if we're talking about the 14th Amendment. When the justices do that, They are not changing the meaning. Sometimes the meaning just gets liquidated. Let me give you two examples. So this is a libertarian forum, so I want to talk about two areas where I think we agree, where we share the value. The first is the value of freedom of speech, right? What it is that enables you to put what you want on your blog and not have to face punishment. In the 18th century, the phrase freedom of speech was generally understood, not by everybody, there were dissenters, but to the extent that we can find a shared meaning, the phrase freedom of speech generally meant that the government could not require prior press licensing, right? So that's it's speech and the press. It's the idea that Milton puts forward in Areopagitica. It's an important principle, but it's very, very far short of our modern conception of freedom of speech. The modern conception of freedom of speech evolves in the early 20th century in a series of dissents by Justices Holmes and Brandeis, and eventually gets recognized by the Supreme Court, first with the liberals in the 1950s and 60s, eventually with the conservatives in the 1980s and 1990s, to where it has become an article of faith that thankfully there is a cross-ideological consensus on. It's not because the framers had a robust conception of freedom of speech, or that anybody at the time would have understood such a robust conception. It is a modern invention, not invented by the judges, but understood by the people. When I said HLA Hart has this idea that what we accept, that we accept the law, what we accept is the law as we've come to understand it. And he didn't invent this idea. Joseph Story, in his commentaries on the Constitution in the early 19th century, says the same thing. He says, you don't look to the hidden meanings because it's what the people accept. The fact that there's no equal rights amendment in the Constitution is a reflection of the fact that our contemporary society accepted women's equality, and so there was no need to amend the Constitution. Under Randi's approach, we would say, did the framers of the 14th Amendment understand that they were adopting a principle of sex equality? Or did those words communicate to them a principle of sex equality? Of course they didn't. How do we know that? We know that because another provision of the very same 14th Amendment, for the first time in the Constitution, introduces a gender line. It tells the Southern states, if you want to disenfranchise people based on various characteristics, and everybody knew that meant race, you can't do so absent losing some of your representation in Congress. And how is that defined? It's by the male inhabitants. So the very people who wrote male inhabitants in the 14th Amendment almost certainly would not have understood the words equal protection to encompass a prohibition on sex discrimination. Now, Randy's about to get up here and tell you, aha, but they didn't say equal protection and their own sexist views. They said equal protection. And what he's going to argue for is living constitutionalism, right? He's going to tell you, you can have your cake and eat it too. So my fundamental argument with Randy is not so much that he's wrong, but that he's facilitating a bait and switch. He gets up here and promotes what he calls originalism by appealing to the virtues of the living Constitution. But then, having done that, people at large, not the erudite members of this audience, but people think, aha, that smart Georgetown law professor has showed why originalism is right, and then they go use it to instantiate the old bad version of originalism that Randy has discredited properly. Now, when I get up again, I'll give you a couple of examples of that ripped from today's headlines, but now it appears, sadly, that my time is up.
Thank you, Professor Dorff. Professor Barnett will take the challenges that have been laid to him in his rebuttal.
That was great, Mike. I expected no less from you. He's a great debater. There's a lot there to talk about. Let me just try to start with this. It would make a difference if the Ninth Amendment were enforced according to its original meaning. It would make a difference
if the Privileges or Immunities Clause was enforced according to its original meaning. It would make a difference if the Commerce Clause was enforced according to its original meaning, if the Necessary and Proper Clause was enforced according to its original meaning, if the Second Amendment was enforced according to its original meaning. It would make a difference if the Contracts Clause was enforced according to its original meaning, unlike this morning, which it wasn't, by a vote of 8-1 with Justice Gorsuch the sole dissenter. It would make a difference if all the parts of what I, in my previous book, called the Lost Constitution were actually restored. And that was the name of the book, the Restoring the Lost Constitution. I didn't mean restoring some old constitutional law from pre-1937. I meant restoring the clauses of the Constitution that caused me to completely turn off of constitutional law because the Supreme Court had ignored them. And if it didn't make a difference, Mike, if those provisions are so open-ended that they could be construed to mean anything that we want them to mean, then why did they have to be redacted? Why did they have to be blotted out? And basically, they are no more. Why can you not go into court and argue any of those provisions and prevail? Because the meaning of those clauses did make a difference, and they had to be gotten out of the way in order to turn the kind of Republican Constitution that we had into a Democratic Constitution of the kind we now have, and that is the title of my book, Our Republican Constitution, the thesis of my book, Our Republican Constitution. So Michael tells you that nobody says that we should disregard the text. Well, I can think of two people who have said something like that. One is Professor David Strauss, who's the author of the book, The Living Constitution, who has adopted what's called a common, there's lots of different variations on living constitutionalism, by the way. There isn't any one. In fact, you really don't know what you're going to get from a living constitutionalist until they open their mouth and tell you, because it could be almost anything. But one of the variations on this is common law constitutionalism, and I think Professor Dorf is actually sympathetic with this particular version. And here is what David Strauss, the author of the book The Living Constitution, said in a Harvard Law Review article just a couple years ago. He said, "Provisions of the text of the Constitution are, to a first approximation, treated in more or less the same way as precedents in a common law system. The effect of constitutional provisions is not fixed at their adoption, or for that matter, at any other time. Instead, like precedents, provisions are expanded, limited, qualified, reconceived, relegated to the background, or all but ignored, depending on what comes afterwards, on subsequent decisions and on judgments about the direction in which the law should develop." That's how he defines living constitutionalism. And in a Harvard Law Review book review of this book, here's what Professor Dorf says about at the end of his very long and very thoughtful, and I highly recommend his book review, by the way. It's a book review of that book and a book by Jack Balkin. And here's how this is how he concludes. He recommends that, quote, "genuinely progressive movements do better to use the Constitution, if at all, strategically and even disingenuously, and that they should not, quote, succumb to the American cult of Constitution worship." So I'm not exactly sure what he means by that. He'll tell us when he rebuts what he meant by that. But I think I'm pretty sure what Professor Strauss means by this. But that is basically that the text of the Constitution is optional, and what really depends on whether the judges today think we should follow it or we should not follow it. That is living constitutionalism, regardless of which variation of living constitutionalism you have. And it would make a difference, I think, if we were to follow the actual meaning of the whole Constitution, not just the favorite parts that we've been left with, which changes the nature of the Constitution itself. I guess the last thing I just want to talk about before I sit down is what he said about what makes law. And he said he was going to give some quotes from my work, so I'll try to fill in that footnote for you. He cited H.L.A. Hart, who is a great man, and his book, The Concept of Law, is a classic work about what makes law law. It is a positivist conception of law, which means law is, according to H.L.A. Hart, based on simply what is accepted. It's not based on what is just or what is right. I personally agree with this, with the aspect of I know what the law is. I can tell what the law is. Whether it's any good or not is another matter. So in that sense, I kind of agree with that idea. When I was a prosecutor, I could tell what the law was, and I can tell what the law is today. I can tell that the law is, for example, that the Second Amendment doesn't mean very much, even after Heller, that the Ninth Amendment doesn't mean very much. I know that that's what today's law is. But then the question is, the real question is the law that's imposed upon us binding in conscience on us? Not whether it's the law, but whether we have any moral duty to obey that law. That's really the question. And the answer that I give in my work is that we have a moral duty to obey the law if there is good reason to believe that those laws that were enacted were both necessary to the protection of rights and proper, they are proper insofar as they don't violate our rights, and they are necessary for the protection of the rights of others. If we have good reason to believe that the laws were enacted for that reason, then we have a good reason to follow the law and have a duty to follow the law, the same reason we have to follow the rights that our fellow citizens have. We have a duty to respect the rights of others. And so the duty comes indirectly through the law if the law is necessary and proper for protecting the rights of others. And then in order to answer that question, you have to ask, do we have a legal system of the kind that can produce laws of that sort? I think that as amended, the Constitution, if followed, could be that legal system, but the Constitution is not followed. And so at that point, I'm not sure that the laws that emerge from it carry with it a duty of obedience, but that's a separate question from what exactly the law is. Now, where did I get this idea from? Is this just my crazy libertarian idea? I would say that this idea is the political philosophy of the United States of America. It is the American political philosophy that was enunciated in our founding document. And our founding document was not the Constitution of the United States, nor was it the Articles of Confederation. It was the Declaration of Independence, which created us as a separate polity. And the Declaration says, of course, as you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are the rights, the individual rights to life, to liberty, and to the pursuit of happiness. Those are each and every individual rights. And then the very next sentence, it gives the American theory of legitimate government. And the next sentence says, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. To secure these rights. So the question we have to ask ourselves is this a structure that can secure these rights if followed? If your answer to that is if followed, that's not a good enough structure for that, well, then you would say the laws that are imposed upon us are not morally binding. But if you think that if followed, this is a structure that could produce laws that are necessary to secure the rights of each and every one of us, each and every one of us, we the people, each and every one, then you'd have to say this is a document that's worth following. But the question is, are we following it now? And the answer is, we are not.
Thank you, Professor Barnett. Professor Dorff, your rebuttal.
Randy paid me the backhanded compliment of saying that I was an excellent debater, which is a way of saying that I was making the weaker argument seem the stronger, as Plato's Gorgias is accused of doing. But I want to pay him a genuine compliment. I want to compare Randy to John Stuart Mill. As you know, Mill was, in some sense, the founder of libertarianism. He wrote a great book on liberty. Mill was also a great utilitarian. That is to say, he followed in the Benthamite tradition, and he refined Bentham's idea to say that there are higher pleasures and lower pleasures. And Mill claimed that he derived his libertarianism from his utilitarianism, but it was not true. He happened to be a utilitarian, and he happened to be a libertarian. You can't derive libertarianism from utilitarianism. If you believe truly in utilitarianism, you'll think that it's okay when the five people needing transplants come into the hospital, it's permissible to sacrifice the person who's there for an appendectomy to take his organs and give them to the different people. That violates people's rights, but a certain kind of utilitarian would say that's okay. Randy's the same way. He was a libertarian before he became an originalist, and he's a libertarian after he became an originalist. It's not because he's deriving libertarianism from the Constitution, although I believe he sincerely thinks he is. Instead, what's going on is, like lots of other people who believe strongly in the living Constitution, he is reading libertarian values into it. Now, there's no doubt that the framers were influenced in ways by libertarian thinkers, including John Locke, but they were principally different from us. Modern libertarianism
is an invention of the 19th and 20th centuries. It's not simply Locke's view that got adopted by the framers. There's a great deal of literature on this. I talked about the First Amendment before. I said there was a second example. The second example I'll give you is the Takings Clause. The original meaning of the Takings Clause, which is the clause of the Fifth Amendment that limits the power of eminent domain, says the government has to pay just compensation, was that it did not apply to what we now call regulatory takings. So if the government actually took your property, they had to pay you just compensation. But if instead they regulated it in such a way that you couldn't use it at all for any economic benefit, most scholars, including the current dean of the Georgetown Law School, argued that the framers would have thought that's fine. Why? Because the framers were what we would now call at least as much civic republicans as they were libertarians. And so if you want a libertarian constitution, adopt a libertarian constitution, but don't pretend you're getting it through the original meaning of the Constitution. Now, one of the things Randy said was that living constitutionalists will often, you don't know what they're going to say until they get up there. That's true of originalists as well. The thing that I said in that Harvard Law Review book review using the Constitution disingenuously, that was not a discussion of Strauss. That was a discussion of the other book that I was reviewing, a book by Yale Law professor Jack Balkin with the provocative title Living Originalism, in which Balkin argues, without apparent intended irony, that living constitutionalism and originalism are really the same thing. Now, various originalists have tried to kick Balkin out of the originalist club because he has publicly admitted that the emperor has no clothes. But the truth is, he's right. Except that, as I told you, it authorizes a kind of switch, a bait and switch. Let me give you two examples. Justice Clarence Thomas is perhaps the most originalist justice on the Supreme Court, and yet he frequently invokes the words public meaning originalism, but then he shifts into old-style originalism, looking at what the framers and ratifiers expected and intended. A good example of that is a case involving violent video games from California a number of years ago, in which Justice Thomas wrote a dissent saying there can't be a First Amendment right to sell violent video games to minors because the framers didn't think that there was a right for strangers to talk to minor children. That's not about what the words freedom of speech meant in 1791. It's about what people expected. It's the old-style originalism. I'll give you another example ripped from today's headlines. Right. Today, the Supreme Court decided 8-1 that the Contracts Clause did not forbid Minnesota from changing its default rule with respect to the beneficiary after a couple gets divorced and one of them dies in an insurance contract. So it's a complicated case, not worth going into. Justice Gorsuch dissents, and he says, you got it wrong. The problem here, he said, is if we look at the original public meaning of the Contracts Clause would have forbidden that. What's his evidence? He tells us what the framers thought. He recites a debate about the ratification. It's the subjective intentions, right? There's that bait and switch. You talk about original public meaning in these sort of fora, but then when it comes to it, you do the discredited form of originalism. Finally, you can't beat somebody with nobody. It's not my job to persuade you to become living constitutionalists. It's just my job to persuade you not to vote for the resolution as Randy has defended it. Let me give you a few alternatives. Maybe you believe in that old religion, right? That old style originalism. If you do, fine. Then you should vote against the resolution. Maybe you believe in judicial restraint. Maybe you think that the best way for the Constitution to be interpreted is for judges to get out of the way and only to overturn the political branches where they've made a clear error. This position has a long and distinguished pedigree. The most famous articulation of it was by Harvard Law professor James Bradley Thayer in the late 19th century, in which he said, unless there's shown that there's something is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt, leave the legislature alone. In modern times, probably the only justice who has practiced this was the second Justice Harlan. But if that's what you think, then vote for that. That's better than Randy's living constitutionalism disguised as originalism. Maybe you think that what we really value is the stability of the law. Columbia Law Professor Tom Merrill wrote a very influential article a number of years ago promoting what he called Burke, not Bork. He said we should be traditional conservatives about this. If you adopt originalism, you won't be preserving the law. If you're going, you'll be undoing all of these settled precedents, and we should have a more common law approach. Another example, the late John Hart Ely, Dean of Stanford Law School, promoted what he called representation reinforcement. He said, we can't trust the political process to protect the rights of minorities and freedom of speech, but otherwise we can. And so only intervene, judges, when you're promoting democracy. Finally, some people who call themselves originalism say we should just follow the law. Will Bode at the University of Chicago Law School is an example of that. He thinks this is a version of originalism. What it really is eclecticism. The justices don't pay fealty to any particular brand of originalism. Otherwise, if you agree with any of those or anything else, then you have to vote against the resolution.
Unless you're in law school or legal academia, you might not realize that you've just listened to two of the finest minds in legal academia today. on both sides of a very complex issue, who really do like each other. So while you are composing your questions, and even though I can't see you, there is a, because the lights are so damn bright in my eyes, there is a microphone sort of to my left and your right. I'm going to take the chair's liberty and pose some questions to my colleagues. Professor Barnett, shortly before he died, the Pope of Originalism, that's Justice Scalia, confessed that he was a soft-hearted originalist when confronted with things like, well, under the Constitution's original public understanding, a horse thief could be branded on the face. What would you do, Justice Scalia, if the state of South Dakota or Montana reinstituted facial branding for horse thievery? He resorted to his soft-hearted originalism that if it made his stomach turn, he wasn't going to be in favor of it. Remaining seated, because you're entitled to rest a little bit, Professor Barnett, would you address the soft-hearted originalism of Nino Scalia?
Yes. Well, I actually wrote an article after he voted against us in the Raich case. I was the lawyer that brought the Gonzalez versus Raich lawsuit on behalf of the citizens of California wanting to use medical marijuana, and the government said that they could regulate this growing of a plant in your backyard under its interstate commerce power. That's reading a lot into the interstate commerce power, and Justice Scalia voted against us, and I was a little annoyed by this, and so I took out my – I can't – there was no other way for me to strike back at a Supreme Court justice other than to write an article. And I wrote an article called Scalia's Infidelity, a Critique of Faint-Hearted Originalism. And what I said in that article was that Justice Scalia did commit, and in fact, I think, although he did, by the way, near the end of his life, say that he wasn't a faint-hearted originalist, but I think he did use what you would call multiple modalities. He did do something that Michael Dorff, I think, rightly criticizes, and that is, for example, he used precedent or stare decisis to overturn to supersede the original meaning, even when he knew the original meaning was otherwise. And I think that was wrong. I mean, in the McDonald case, which applied the right to keep and bear arms to the states, the appropriate part of the 14th Amendment by which that should be done is the Privileges or Immunities Clause, which says no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. That sounds like that's really important, doesn't it? But guess what? The Supreme Court disregarded that provision in 1873 and has not adhered to it since. And Justice Scalia, when Alan Gura, the lawyer in that case, argued that he should enforce the right to keep and bear arms under the appropriate provision, Justice Scalia made fun of him in open court, saying, what are you doing, bucking for a position on a law school faculty?
Yes, yes.
He called it the darling of the professoriate. That's wrong. That was wrong. That was wrong behavior by Justice Scalia, in my opinion. And he shouldn't have mocked somebody for asserting part of the Constitution. And so, look, we're all flawed, and we all make mistakes. And I have no heroes on the Supreme Court. I don't even have any heroes looking back in history on the Supreme Court. Possibly the first Justice Harlan might be a hero of mine because he was a dissenter in Plessy. But other than that, I don't have heroes. They're all. Everybody makes mistakes. Justice Thomas makes mistakes. Justice Gorsuch is going to make mistakes. But here's the thing. Michael criticizes them because instead of adhering to this version of originalism, he's adhering to that version of originalism, the bad one. But he can tell the difference. And by being able to tell the difference, you have a basis for criticism. And that's what originalism gives you, a basis for criticism. If, in fact, the only criticism is that, look, he didn't reach the result we like, and we all want different results, then that is not a basis for criticism on the basis of the Constitution.
All right, Professor Dorff, Professor Barnett brings up a very famous case in which he was the litigant involving the medical marijuana in California, in which essentially the Supreme Court found that Professor Barnett's client, Angel Raich, whom I have interviewed several times, who grew marijuana in her backyard and used it only for her own use, pursuant to a prescription from her physician and authorization from the state of California. She didn't sell it, she didn't move it, other than her backyard, somehow was engaged in interstate commerce. Is that not the height of applying a modern-day version of interstate commerce as opposed to what the framers intended, Professor Dorff? And if that is the height of it, how do we prevent against it?
This is an argument that's been going on since the founding. So those of you who aren't familiar with American history might have seen the musical Hamilton, at least. So you'll recall that Hamilton and Jefferson were rivals, both within the Washington administration. So there was a proposal by Hamilton and others to create a Bank of the United States. Don't worry, I'll get to the question.
McCulloch against Maryland.
Yes, to create a Bank of the United States, which would have certain powers and abilities and would facilitate various of the functions of the government. And Washington wasn't sure that this was going to be constitutional. So he asked Hamilton, whom he knew would favor the bank, to write a memo supporting its constitutionality. He asked Jefferson, and he also asked Edmund Randolph, and I forgot who the third one was. He asked somebody else as well to write memos against it because he really wanted to hear the case as well as could be argued. And here's what Jefferson said. Jefferson said, of course you don't have the power to create a bank. There's a list of the powers of Congress in Article 1, Section 8. It's not there. It doesn't say create a bank. Game over. Hamilton said, not so fast. In order to carry out those powers, the government has to have incidental powers. One of those incidental powers could be to create a bank. Now, fast forward to 1819. It's now the second Bank of the United States, created after James Madison as president didn't let the bank lapse, and so we almost lost the War of 1812. So now we have the second Bank of the United States. And the case is, it's challenged, goes up to the Supreme Court, and John Marshall basically plagiarizes Hamilton's memo and says the bank is constitutional. There has, since the very beginning, been a battle over the scope of the Commerce Clause and other powers. I don't really have a strong view about that. What I will say in support of Justice Scalia's position is that he wasn't writing on a clean slate. In addition to Hamilton and Marshall, he also had the Supreme Court that had said you could regulate how much wheat a farmer can grow during the 1930s under the Agricultural Adjustment Act. And he said basically pot is like wheat. If they can tell you how much bread you can grow, then that's interstate commerce, then so is pot. Now, maybe that's right, maybe it's wrong, but I don't think we can fault Justice Scalia for saying that there is precedent and we have to follow precedent unless it's clearly wrong and unworkable, because otherwise every day you wake up and the whole law can be undone.
All right, I'm going to ask one more question to each of our debaters. Professor Barnett, does the phrase in the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law, mean no law?
Yes. It means no law, but then the rest of the amendment says abridging the freedom of speech. And so you have to then ask, what is an abridgment of freedom of speech, or infringing the freedom of speech? What is an infringement of the freedom of speech? So just so no law that infringed the freedom of speech or the right of freedom of speech. You have to first of all define what is the right of freedom of speech, and then what is an infringement on that right, and then no law should be passed that does those things. But then, so just being no law doesn't give us the answer to the question.
In
fact, let me make a more general point. In the parts of the Constitution that living constitutionalists like to point to as being so open-ended that they basically don't tell us very much, there actually are more words in those clauses than we're normally told. So the Equal Protection Clause says it's the equal protection of the laws. The Due Process Clause, it's the due process of law. There are more words that have more meaning, and sometimes these meanings are a little more definite than we're told. And in the case of the First Amendment, which you asked me about, Judge, there's the rest of the words of the First Amendment that go along with shall make no law.
Professor Dorff, how do you accept Professor Barnett's challenge that if we are not bound by the original document, what do we do if five justices just decide, the 10th Amendment is just a truism, the 9th Amendment is just an ink blot, nobody believes in the Contracts Clause anymore, because we have just accepted a society in which the 9th Amendment and the 10th Amendment and the Contracts Clause are meaningless? How would we confront that?
So first of all, they don't actually say that, right? They don't say, Judge Bork famously said that the 9th Amendment must be construed as though it's overwritten by an ink blot. And he said that while professing to be an originalist. So the idea of construing provisions of the Constitution effectively out of the Constitution is something that people who claim to be originalists do as well. I would also reject the premise a little bit, right? That is to say, Randy and I are in complete agreement that you have to try to construe the text, right? I don't think, so look, if I were writing a constitution, I might, because I'm a pinko, right, I might be informed by the experience of post-war constitution writers,
right,
who include so-called social, economic, and cultural rights in their constitution, so-called positive rights. But, you know, I can read, I can see that our Constitution doesn't contain such affirmative rights. And so I think that this is a parody of the way in which courts actually deal with these questions. Also, we shouldn't conflate paying attention to the text of the Constitution with the original meaning. You see that, by the way, in Justice Gorsuch's dissent today in the Sveen case. He says, look, the Contracts Clause says that no state shall pass a law impairing the obligation of contracts. It doesn't say substantially impairing the obligation of contracts. That's why he's dissenting. Well, he's right about that. But, of course, that's just about the text. That's a textual argument. Nobody has ruled out textual arguments. The burden of originalism is not to say that the original understanding matters. Everybody agrees it matters. The burden is to say that it matters more than anything else, including precedents that have built up over centuries.
All right, we'll start with whoever is first there. The chair reserves the right. I don't think I'll do this to the great Tom Woods, but the chair.
All right.
The chair reserves the right to modify the wording of the question. Not a speech, a question. Professor Woods.
So it's a living text, in other words, my question?
All right. As you are alive, your question is alive.
Professor Dorff, I guess I'm unconvinced by your claim that it's a caricature of living constitutionalism to say that judges are simply substituting their preferences for the words of the Constitution. Then how do we account for what happened to the 10th Amendment? How do we go from a revolution fought for local self-government, Jefferson saying the 10th Amendment is the cornerstone of the Constitution, half a dozen state ratifying conventions saying the federal government has only the powers expressly delegated to it, to then the court saying the 10th Amendment is merely tautological, and now we have a situation where if you take a crash course preparing for the bar exam, one of the test-taking pieces of advice they will give you is that in the multiple choice section, if one of the answers is the 10th Amendment, you know that's wrong. That's never right. That does not sound like a living constitution to me. It sounds like a dead constitution.
Professor Dorff.
With due respect, you did not hear the text of the 10th Amendment in that question. What the 10th Amendment says is that the powers not delegated to federal government are reserved to the states or the people. The argument that it's a tautology is an argument that recapitulates Madison's argument against the need for a Bill of Rights and also Jefferson's argument against the need for a Bill of Rights, the idea that the federal government is a government of enumerated powers. And what the Tenth Amendment literally says is, if a power is not granted to the federal government, it's reserved to the states. What the Supreme Court has done in its Tenth Amendment jurisprudence is not to eliminate the Tenth Amendment, but actually to embellish it in favor of, and I don't think they're wrong in doing so, but I think they've, what they've done is to embellish it in favor of a made-up principle, right? It's one of the questions I asked before, right? Can Congress tell the states they have to enforce federal law? Supreme Court said no in a case called Prince against the United States. I think it's a perfectly good living constitutional principle that Congress can't tell the states they have to enforce federal law. You will find it nowhere in the text of the Constitution. Not least will you find it in, and you certainly will find it in the Tenth Amendment, which says if the power is not delegated to the federal government. Well, here it is a power that's delegated to the federal government that they're talking about in the particular case. And so it's just not true that the court has read the Tenth Amendment out. And people using any variety of constitutional methods can reach results that they want. I have a further comment, but I'm going to stop because I want to get other people's questions and maybe give Randy a chance to respond.
Thank you. A question for Professor Barnett, please.
Thank you. Professor Barnett, you said that Madison's notes were kept secret until 1844, if I'm correct. Correct me, either one of you, I'm not a constitutional lawyer or a historian, but that at the time of the Constitutional Convention, there was a Continental Congress meeting at the same time. The Constitutional Convention was directed to propose amendments to the Articles of Confederation, which basically, if any changes were to occur, if I understand correctly, all states, all 13, had to agree. Yet the Constitution would take power once 9 ratified it. Now, what I understand in law is that fruit from the poison tree is poisoned. So if you are going to say and are going to argue originalism, shouldn't then you should also argue that the Constitution is actually an illegal document and fruit from the poison tree?
Professor Barnett, after all this, are you loyal to a poisonous tree?
Look, this is an interesting question, and I'm familiar with the question, and I'm familiar with the period. I don't have the time to refute this claim that the Constitution was illegally ratified. I will simply say that the convention that took place in Philadelphia was a convention of the states, that, in fact, the commissioners that went to that convention, most of the commissioners were authorized to do what they did. And, in fact, it took a unanimous vote to get into the Union, in the sense that it's true the Constitution would get up and running if three-quarters of the states adopted it. But no state would join the Constitution unless they adopted it. And for 2 years, North Carolina and Rhode Island stayed out of the Constitution. So it ultimately was adopted by all the states, unanimously adopted by all the states, or they wouldn't have been forced to stay in it. All right,
I agree with that, by the way.
Yeah. So, but here's the thing. I don't make an argument from authority about why we should follow the Constitution. I don't think we should follow the Constitution because the people that lived then have authority over us today. I say we should follow the Constitution because we here today are subject to the laws that are made by people who take an oath to follow that text, however it came about. That's the oath they take. And they only get the power they are given in return for them making that oath. And if, as Lysander Spooner once said, in fact, in talking about people who make oaths, if the oath they take is to follow the Constitution, whatever they themselves personally may decide that it means, that is literally, as Spooner said, an oath to nothing. And but in return for that oath, we give them that power. No. They have to live up to their oath, and they have to uphold this Constitution, meaning the written one, regardless of how it came about.
A question for Professor Dorff.
Thank you. This could be for both the debaters. What does the Second Amendment mean, if anything?
Well, we'll let the Pinko go first. Self-described Pinko, for whom I have great respect and affection.
So let me give you one, what I think is the best understanding of the Second Amendment. So at some point a number of years ago, I looked into what I could find about the original understanding. What I found was the phrase "bear arms" was overwhelmingly, but not exclusively, overwhelmingly used in the time of the adoption of the Constitution to mean military service. Now, the Second Amendment also refers to keep and bear arms, and so you could say that means you have a right to private storage of that. But for the most part, it does look like the Second Amendment was a bit of a puzzle, because the big gripe that people had at the time was that the original Constitution would give the Congress the power to create a standing army. And the framers were very much against standing armies. Now, the reason the Second Amendment is a puzzle is because it doesn't forbid Congress from creating a standing army. Federal government still has that power and indeed can nationalize state militias. And since the Militia Act of 1900 or so, they do that routinely. So it's a bit of a puzzle. But Professor Amar at Yale has a very, I think, interesting read on the history, which is by the time of the adoption of the 14th Amendment in 1868, the view that Randy takes of the Second Amendment, which is that it protects an individual right to keep your firearms for personal self-defense and maybe for some other purposes, hunting, etc., that view had taken hold. So if you take the position that the Constitution should be read to mean what it communicated to the public at the time, then I think the best reading is there is no individual right to firearms against the federal government, but there may be against the states, because that's what gets incorporated by the 14th Amendment. One final point is that my view is a little idiosyncratic, which is I think there is a natural right of self-defense, which is probably protected by the 9th Amendment, independent of the
laws. You are really appealing to the guru of the 9th Amendment now. When you say natural right. Now,
I agree with that, and I also agree with what you say about the 14th Amendment. Let me just say this about the Second Amendment.
Please.
Because obviously it's a big topic with lots of evidence. In the 1960s, when the gun control debate started, there was developed a theory that the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, meant the right of a state to have a militia. It was an argument that got going in the 60s. Most but not all circuit courts of appeals eventually accepted that argument. In the 70s and the 80s, serious scholars went to work, including progressives like Sandy Levinson of the University of Texas, and really produced a tremendous amount of evidence that showed that it really was not anything about a right of states to have a militia. In fact, that would be a very strange way for the founders to have written it. It was about a right of individuals, like all the other rights that belong to the people that are in the first 10 amendments. They're all individual rights, the rights that belong to the people. In response to that, by the time the case of United States versus Heller came up and they were interpreting the Second Amendment, by this time, those people who were in favor of the other side, in favor of gun control, they had abandoned the collective rights view. They had abandoned the collective rights view, and you know that they've abandoned it because Justice Stevens, in his dissent in Heller, doesn't follow it. He doesn't say that the meaning of the Second Amendment is the right of states to have a militia. He says it protects an individual right to bear arms in a militia. That was a completely newly developed theory that developed in the 2000s. To respond to evidence that had been developed in the 80s and the 90s. And so that is the state of the debate. I think the evidence is overwhelming that it's an individual right, but that does not mean that the right cannot be regulated, just as the right of freedom of speech is regulated by time, place, and manner regulations of speech, for example. What matters is that they be reasonable regulations and not regulations that are designed to suppress a right with which the government disagrees, which is unfortunately what many gun control laws proposed are about.
Next question, please, for either of our participants.
My question is for Professor Barnett. Article 1 says that all legislative powers are invested in Congress. Does that imply that does originalism imply that the entire administrative regulatory state at a federal level is unconstitutional?
First of all, it's very important that the first sentence of Article 1 says all legislative powers herein granted are given to Congress, which is one reason why the 10th Amendment was thought to be superfluous, because the first sentence of Article 1 already says that Congress only has the powers herein granted. Herein means herein what? Means herein this booklet, herein this. That's what it meant. So, and that's how federalism is preserved under this document, because Congress only has all those powers, and then all the other powers are either in the states or the people. All right. So now, as for the administrative state, look, the Constitution clearly presupposes that there is going to be departments and officers of the departments. And so a department is the same. You could call it an agency, a Department of Justice. There wasn't a Department of Justice until actually much later. But the idea that there would be departments and department heads is clearly contemplated by the text of the Constitution. And the people who are the cabinet officers would actually have to make reports to the president when he wants one. So there can be what you might call a body of individuals who are there to execute the laws that are passed by Congress. You can call that the administrative state. When we're talking about the constitutionality of the administrative state, it is not that we're talking about. We're really talking about whether these individuals who are not elected and not accountable and they're not confirmed by Congress necessarily, whether they have the power to actually make law that binds us. Not whether that they can make laws to execute how the government operates, but whether they actually can make laws to bind us. And what has happened, as you know, and your question presupposes this, is that the Congress is really to blame for this as much as the courts, have decided to offload the lawmaking powers to this group because they can make more laws that way. Congress doesn't only have 535 of them. They can only make so many laws. They want to make a lot more laws than that. So they create lawmakers who are in the administrative state to make these laws, and that's the part that is constitutionally suspect. But there are ways in which that could be fixed without abolishing everything that currently exists.
All right, let me tell you what we're going to do now. Each of our debaters will have 5 minutes to sum up. We will start with Professor Dorff and then Professor Barnett, and then we're going to vote. During the time of the voting, which is about 5 or 6 minutes, we have some folks who have been pre-designated to come up here and make some announcements to you that I think you'll find quite interesting. So for his closing argument, Professor Dorff.
Thank you so much, Judge. And let me just say, however this comes out, I've enjoyed this tremendously. It's always a pleasure to debate these issues with Randy or just to discuss them, and I appreciate all the terrific questions. I have a few simple points to reiterate by way of summation. The first and most important one is don't be fooled by the bait and switch that Professor Barnett is trying to hook you with, right? That is to say, he wants to tell you that you can have a libertarian constitution because, you know, you can massage these clauses because we're not bound by the original intentions. It comes out the way you want it to come out, right? That's what original public meaning originalism is. That's what Professor Balkin admitted in his book, Living Originalism, right? If that's what originalism is, fine. I'm okay with that. But don't call it originalism, because then justices on the Supreme Court and people in public debate are going to use the patina of respectability that you've now created for the term originalism to justify the bad kind of originalism that even Randy condemns. Second, Randy tells you that, you know, we don't want judges changing the meaning of the law. I don't want judges changing the meaning of the law either, but that's not what happens. And in any event, there's no evidence that adopting the phrase originalism as a label for your jurisprudence is going to constrain you as a judge. Political scientists, not just law professors, study the Supreme Court. And what they find is that you can predict about 80% of how justices on the Supreme Court are going to vote just by coding them ideologically. Right? Conservative justices think that affirmative action is unconstitutional, but same-sex marriage prohibition is constitutional. Liberal justices, the opposite. Right? It's not about their jurisprudential philosophy. It's about their underlying values. And that's not surprising, nor is it shameful, because the terms of the Constitution that matter to us are very often unclear. Right? Now, Randy's going to tell you, well, none of those justices is doing the right kind of originalism. They're not following my book, he's going to tell us. Right? Fair enough. But it reminds me, in
modality and way of argument, if not, although obviously not in terms of its consequences, of an argument that you sometimes hear from communists, right? So the communist will say, you know, we ought to have a dictatorship of the proletariat where each from his ability to each according to his needs. And you say, well, yeah, that was tried in the Soviet Union, in Mao's China, in Cuba. It was a disaster. And the communist says, no, those weren't real communist systems. Right? So from Randi we learn, Justice Scalia, no, he's not an originalist. Justice Thomas, well, I read you example, and I gave you an example of the California violent video game. He's not a public meaning originalist. When he claims to be an originalist, he's doing the old bad style of originalism. Looks like today Justice Gorsuch did the very same thing. And so if nobody is actually an instantiation of the philosophy, that suggests one of two things. Either the philosophy doesn't really bind people, or it's not a real thing, right? There's a reason why Professor Balkin called his book Living Originalism. Finally, come back to Madison, right? Madison tells us, right? I'm not appealing to him because he wrote the Constitution, although that's a pretty good basis for authority. He doesn't have inherent authority because of that. I'm appealing to him because he's such a smart guy. He tells us it's impossible for the meaning to be baked in from the beginning. They're creating a constitution for what was then 3 million people that now governs a polity of over 300 million people. It would be astounding if what they said would have embedded in it answers to all of our most pressing questions. We can look to it, and of course we have to look to it, to guide us, but most of these questions are not ultimately going to be answered by staring hard at the text and asking, well, what did people think these words meant then? They didn't have a view about our problems. Our problems are our problems.
Thank you, Professor Dorff. Professor Barnett, your summation.
Well, Michael, a couple times has said that I think that we have a libertarian constitution or that I read the Constitution to be a libertarian constitution. I really don't think that's true, or at least I try hard not to read my politics into the Constitution, because I don't think we have a perfectly libertarian constitution, and I don't think that you should vote affirmatively for the proposition that you're being asked to vote on because you think that we have a libertarian constitution in any kind of pure sense. I mean, for example, let's take the Commerce Clause. I mean, the founders of the framers of the Constitution, the founding generation, were mercantilists. They were not free traders. And the commerce power, when I went out to do originalist research on the original meaning of the Commerce Clause while I was doing the Raich case, and I was hoping to find the evidence that showed that the meaning of regulate in Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with Indian tribes, that to regulate meant to make regular, and it did not mean to prohibit, because it really wasn't until 1903 that the Supreme Court held that it did mean to prohibit in a case called Champion versus Ames. So I went out to show that it meant just to make regular and not to prohibit. I found that the evidence was that it did include the power to prohibit and not just to regulate. In fact, Madison had a phrase he used called a prohibitory regulation. And why did it? Why did they choose a word? I'm not doing original expected application. I'm saying, why did they choose a word like regulate that would have included the power of prohibition? And that is because in regulating commerce with foreign nations, they wanted to be able to stop commerce with foreign nations as well as facilitate it. They wanted to be able to enter into trade deals in which they could threaten to withhold the commerce of the United States unless they got a deal from another country, et cetera, or to protect native industries against foreign competition. I'm against those on policy grounds, just as I'm against the tariffs that the president is proposing now on policy grounds. And so I don't think the Constitution is a perfectly libertarian one. But here's what I think. I think, first of all, if it were actually followed, it would be one of the most libertarian constitutions as a relative basis of any constitution that would actually be in existence in the world. It would be a very libertarian constitution, though not a perfectly one. And let's put it this way. It would be more libertarian than the living constitution that we've been given by the justices. and in some cases by dead justices. And so what Michael and those who would follow, for example, precedent that would override the original public meaning of the text would have you follow is not the words of this text, but in fact the words that were written by sometimes long dead justices in the pages of the United States Supreme Court Reporter. Why we should follow those words and somehow interpret those words according to their original meaning and not interpret these words according to its original meaning is a bit of a mystery. Because I'm going to go back to my original point. This is not the law that governs us. This is the law that governs those who govern us. Each and every one of those people take an oath to follow this Constitution, the written one, and those who are there to follow this Constitution can no more change the law that governs them than we can change the laws that govern us without going through the amendment process. And that means following the whole Constitution. There are no ink blots on this Constitution. I was opposed to Robert Bork when he said that. The Wall Street Journal editorial page editorialized against that statement at the time he made it because it was so outrageous that you're not going to be able to figure out what the Ninth Amendment means. And so that means restoring the Ninth Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Commerce Clause, the Contracts Clause, the Privileges or Immunities Clause, and we could go down the list of other clauses, the Recess Appointments Clause, which has only been kind of followed. We can go down the list of all the clauses that the judges have said, long dead judges have said, are not to be followed, and I think that we should move back in the direction of adhering to the whole Constitution, because if we do, I think this is a system of government. It's a system of lawmaking that's capable of making laws that are necessary and proper to respect the individual rights of we the people, each and every one of us. Thank you.
And now I want to announce the results of the voting. The yes vote started at 59%, went up to over 60%, picked up one percentage point. That's the number to beat. The no vote went from 10% to 30%, picked up 20 percentage points. So the Tootsie Roll goes to the negative. Congratulations, Michael. Congratulations, Andrew.